Thomas Davis is wanting to know, I'm looking to upgrade to a 30 to 34 foot boat and have seen lots of options with the older 350s. Are they reliable slash good? So Thomas, thank you for subscribing. Thank you for commenting. This is a really, really good topic, especially because Yamaha now has a brand new V6 4.3 liter F350, opposed to what he's talking about being the old F350 5.3 liter V8 engine that some people do not think is reliable or good. So there's quite a bit to talk about here. I also have a couple more questions of people asking about the F350. I'll just go ahead and read those comments now, so that way you can kind of see, you know, we'll have a few of the talking points before we get into the conversation, because I'm not sure exactly how I'm going to lead through all this because there are so many different talking points. So Johnny Dime says, what do you think about the F300 or the 350 horsepower Yamahas built between 2011 and 2015? Are they known for being reliable? Mark also says that the firing order is the problem with the F350. It creates harmonic imbalance and fails the rotor, and then causes crankshaft failure in worst case scenarios. And then TK says, some people say that the problem with the Yami 350 was crank bearings making the flywheel go out of balance. So as far as reliability goes, we will talk about the V6 4.3, but on the 5.3 liter, in my opinion, I want to say that yes, that's a reliable engine, but it is just like every other engine. It is very generational. So I want to say the engine came out late 2007. So it's basically like an 08 till they produced it until 2020. In 2020, they stopped making it. It was a heavy engine. I want to say somewhere around like 900 pounds. Not 100% on that, but I want to say it's like 900 pounds. So it's a heavy engine, and it was completely different than anything else that they've ever made. From 07 until like 2010, 2011, somewhere in there, that was the F350A, which is a Generation A model. And then I want to say from 10, 11, somewhere in there, up until 15, 16, somewhere in there, that is the Generation B. So the Generation B model, and then from like late 15, 16 until 2020 when they discontinued it, that was the F350C model. So you've got A, B, and C. So what Johnny's talking about here, the 11 to 15, that's basically going to be the Generation B models. Generation A had quite a few problems. That's probably where they got the biggest rap of having issues with the F350 outside of it being so, so heavy. But the main problems were, one, they had flywheel issues, which might be more related to what Mark is talking about with the firing order. And basically the situation was that if you ran the engine in a certain RPM range, there was a balancer that was built onto the flywheel. And so the balancer would actually separate from the flywheel, and if it was left unaddressed, it would fly off. You know, I mean, it would separate off of it. And now you have a balancer, which is weighted. So that weighted balancer is would fly off the top of the engine, basically. There is a plastic shroud on top of it, and then you've got the cowling. So, you know, is this balancer going to fling off the top, go through the shroud and out the side of the cowling? I mean, I don't know if they've really had any of those cases. Now, if you're running the engine without the cowling, without the shroud, and that thing came off, yeah, you probably got a problem there. But, you know, that was kind of one of the things. And then there were the what TK said, that there were some crank problems. There was like a planar bearing that would go, but I want to say that most of that is like what Mark is saying. The worst case scenario would be crankshaft failure being due to the balancing issue of the engine. There was also the exhaust manifolds on the back of the engine. They had these bubble backs. They were like scuba tanks, and these exhaust manifolds would actually crack, and it would allow water to get into the engine, and then it would lock it up in the short. There's obviously more there. And then I also want to say that the Generation A models, which had most of these problems, a lot of them got figured out with the B, and then the C model was basically the only thing wrong with it was you would have to replace the flywheels. but that's a whole different, we'll talk about that in a second. The problem, I didn't really deal a lot with this because I'm not in freezing conditions. I don't have to deal with the water freezing and having a problem. But from my understanding, what I've read, what I've heard, what I've seen, as far as like talking to people, is that the Generation A in those exhaust manifolds, that would not drain the water all the way out if it got left in the down position. So I guess what you would have to do is you'd have to trim the engine up and let it drain, trim it down, let it drain, and then I maybe trim it up again and then back down again in order to get some water out of the exhaust. Or maybe you couldn't get the water out of the exhaust, and then when it would freeze, it would crack it, and then when it would crack, boom, you got water into the cylinders, lock it up, you know, the hole, there you go, big problem. So that was the main issue with them, was the exhaust. But then there was also other corrosion issues, stuff like that. The trim units on them were very known for corroding and rusting and not holding up for a very long period of time. But as far as a trim unit problem goes, we would paint them. So, you know, once you got the trim units, they would come, they were black, you would paint them and then put them on. And the paint kind of helps to eliminate the corrosion rusting issue that was being seen on them. So was that, you know, a massive problem that you have to deal with? Yeah, I don't really know. Also on Generation A, so the Generation A, before they figured out the issue with the flywheel that is, you know, we're going to get to Mark's comment about the harmonic balancing of it, but they figured out that they had the flywheel problem, and so eventually they figured out that if the engine was ran in a certain RPM range, that range being 3,400 to 4,250, I want to say it's 4,250. Yeah, I might be wrong. It might be like 38 to 42 or something like that, but I want to say it's 3,400 to 4,250 is the RPM range, and if you had run that engine in that range for 80 hours, that's what would throw would make the imbalance, the harmonic imbalance of the engine to mess up that flywheel and get the rotor, which is what they call it. They call the flywheel a rotor, which had a balancer built on top of it. And that would get that balancer and the flywheel to actually separate, and that's what the issue was. And then obviously, as soon as the engine went out of balance, if that balancer separated, then you would have a big problem with the balancing of the engine, which would then proceed to have problems with the crank and where the planar bearings and that stuff would fail because the imbalance of the flywheel. I mean, you think about the crankshaft spinning on a V8, 5.3 liter, it's a big engine. So from the bottom of the crankshaft to the top where that balancer gets out of whack. Now all of a sudden you've got all this weight at the top that is spinning around imbalanced. It's putting stress all over that crank and it's going to start to wobble inside these very, very tight journals and tolerances between the crankshaft, the crank rods, the bearings, you know, the whole assembly of a combustion engine. And what would happen if it goes out of balance? So actually, let me do this. I do have one. I'll show you exactly what would happen with the flywheel. So here is your flywheel, and you can see it is completely separated. And if you give me a second, I will actually pull this off. If you look, this completely come off. So this is actually the balancer. Here's your flywheel, and it threw this off of the flywheel. And again, that's the worst case scenario. And that is exactly what we're talking about with the flywheel coming apart. That balancer, that ring, that thing would actually separate and it would start spinning separate from the flywheel, which would give you all of these problems. Now, what Mark is talking about with the flywheel and the harmonic balancing of the engine and the firing order, that very well may be part of the issue. And the Generation A also had different ignition coils and stuff to it. So the way the ignition coils were, they had a knock sensor basically like built into the ignition coil in a way. And, you know, they had problems with that as well. But other than that, you know, there weren't too much more outside of those issues with it being corrosion, the exhaust, the flywheel, and then, you know, if it was left untamed, then yeah, you would have actual, you know, catastrophic failure of the engine based on those issues. Other than that, it was just a heavy engine. It was super powerful. I mean, it's a 5.3 liter V8, so it had nasty torque for a big engine. I mean, that thing had really, really good torque. It could push a lot of weight. It could sling a really big prop. So as far as reliability goes, in my opinion, yeah, they're going to be a reliable engine outside of those issues. And once you knew about those issues, then for most of them, you know, there was workarounds, like the RPM issue being that if you ran the engine between 3,400 and 4,250, that over 80 hours, that's what would cause the problem of the flywheel. And you would get a code 87. Just to finish up on the Generation A, what they also did was they changed out the ECUs. So you would put a new ECU on there that would then track the time spent and in that RPM range. So as soon as you ran 80 hours inside that RPM range, which was pretty much cruising speed. So, you know, as far as most people getting their fuel economy and their cruising range and their cruising speed, that RPM, I mean, was pretty well in there. But if you were to run it at 4,400, that's probably cruising speed too, especially with a V8. I mean, that big V8 was built to move a lot of power, a lot of weight. So like what Thomas is talking about, buying a 30-34 foot boat, if you bought a 30-34 foot boat with twin V8 F350s, your probably cruising speed is going to be closer to 4,500, maybe 46, 47, maybe even 5,000, depending on the boat and the weight. So 3,400 to 42, that's going to be closer to your trolling speed. So now your trolling speed on a big boat like that, you might be trolling at 3,400, 3,500. So there you go. There's that concept to be thinking about as well. But as far as the ECU, you would swap out the ECU. And I would say that there's probably very, very few Generation A F350s left out there that have not had an ECU replacement, unless you find a 2008, 2009 F350 that has 75 hours on the engine. You know, that might not have the ECU replaced yet, but as far as my knowledge goes, I want to say that they are still replacing the flywheels. So you would get the ECU and you would also get the flywheel replaced by Yamaha for free. So you would take it to a dealer, they would replace the flywheel or the rotor, and they would put a new ECU on there. Once you swapped the ECU once, you never had to swap it again. So again, unless you can find a 15-year-old engine that only has 60, 70 hours on it, then other than that, most of them have probably had an ECU put on them whenever the ECU were replaced. Another issue was that the tilt range and the hours, you know, if you change the ECU or the computer on any engine, then you're going to lose all of the data that was stored on the engine. There wasn't really ever a way to take data from one computer and put it onto another computer outside of some configuration data. So when you do an ECU or PCM replacement on pretty much every outboard engine, you would lose engine hours and stuff like that. Some of the calibration stuff, you would lose all that. So on the F350, a lot of them would have a tilt limiter. So on the tilt limiter is basically you set a range for the engine to trim up out of the water. And then when it gets to a certain tilt range, it would stop based on that tilt limiter. And you would have to reset that because, you know, on some of these boats, it was a big engine. So when it would tilt out on some boats, the cowling would hit the back of the transom. And so that was kind of one thing. I don't know if I'd really say that was a problem or something that you would be concerned about in these days. You know, it's 2024. So we're talking about stuff that happened, you know, 10, 15 years ago. But other than that, that's maybe something that I would think about. Now, when it comes to Mark's discussion on the harmonic balancing of it, I don't think anyone's ever going to come out. I don't think you're ever going to see Yamaha make a statement and say that it was a firing order issue. That's just not, brands and manufacturers don't do that. Obviously, everybody points blame to other things opposed to, or there is always a legal or a politically correct way to say something. But I think that there is something to the firing order and the harmonic balancing of the engine myself personally. And I'll tell you why. So the reason why I kind of agree with Mark and what he's saying is because Yamaha's firing order for most of their engines is pretty much all the same. So in general, unless the engine is a four-cylinder, if it's a one, if it's a two, I mean, if it's a three, like any of those or a V6 and up, it is going to have the same firing order. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So the 4.2 liters, the singles, the 200s, like all that stuff has a firing order of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And then like the four cylinders was 1, 3, 4, 2. And then like the F50, which is a four cylinder, all the way down to the 175 2.8 liter and the F200 2.8 liter, that's 1, 3, 4, 2. So everything is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, unless it's a four cylinder. If it's a four cylinder, it's 1, 3, 4, 2. Now, knowing that, pretty much everything on Yamaha is that that's it. So that makes it super simple. The reason we talk about the firing order on the V8 and the 5.3 liter is because the F350 had a firing order of 1, 8, 4, 3, 6, 5, 7, 2. So it's completely different. And then, you know, here's where everybody is going to get the, it was a firing order problem, whether or not, you know, anybody has that technical data and the, you know, actual information to back that up, that was the problem. You know, I don't have that. And I don't know if anybody does, but you go to the V8 XTO, which is, it's a V8 engine. You would think if the V8 F350 was on point, then they wouldn't change. As you can see with everything else Yamaha does, it's all the same. It doesn't change. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 3, 4, 2. That never changes. It's always the same. And so the F350, that has the 1, 8, 4, 3, 6, 5, 7, 2. But then when we look at the V8 XTO, 425, 450, they had the 375 for a little while. When we look at that, it's a V8 engine. And its firing order is 1, 2, 7, 3, 4, 5, 6, 8. So if there wasn't a problem with the firing order of the F350 and the flywheel problem and the harmonic balancing of the engine, which the firing order has a lot to do with the harmonic balancing of it because of what position the stroke is on the piston, you know, which piston on the crank in its location, where it's at on exhaust, where it's at on compression, where it's at on, you know, the power stroke, all that has to do with the harmonic balancing of the engine. That's why the L6 is, they say the perfectly balanced engine because of the way it can harmonically balance itself. So if there wasn't a problem with the firing order, why on the XTO did they go to 1, 2, 7, 3, 4, 5, 6, 8? 1, 2, 7, 3, 4, 5, 6, 8. So they only really swapped 7 and 8 as far as the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. They just put the 7 after 2, and then that was pretty much it. They just moved one fire out down to the third cylinder. So I don't know. That's kind of the evidence that everybody has. That's why Mark is saying that it is going to be the firing order that threw it out of harmonic balance. I don't know if that's really true, but that's kind of where we get that. And I mean, it's super easy. It's different. So why would, if there wasn't a problem there, then why would they change it? Cause if there wasn't a problem, then just like they have for everything else, like every single engine, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and then four cylinders, 1, 3, 4, 2, you know, it's a tried, proven thing. They don't change it since 1984 when they first started coming to the United States. Like, that's been the mantra. So I would say that there might be something there. Whether you'll ever hear that out of the manufacturer, probably not. But that's what I got to say about the F350. Anything above that, the V6 4.3 liter, I think that thing is going to be super reliable. I don't have the firing order on that, but my guess is that it's going to be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And I think it's going to be a super reliable platform. It's still too new to say any kind of issues with it. I think that it's basically built on the 4.2 liter platform, but they did make, you know, some changes to it. The stroke length of the piston has gotten a little bit longer. That's how they got the 4.3 over the 4.2 liter. They got that extra space because of a stroke length or something like that. And they only made minor changes, but the 4.2 liter platform has been such a reliable engine that I don't really see where there could be any kind of catastrophic, oh my goodness, we've got problems. Like with the F-350, the flywheel, the exhaust, like those were, like that's a big deal. We're talking about catastrophic failures. Whenever those things fail, it's a problem to the engine and it'll destroy the engine. So I don't think we're going to see that out of the 4.2 liter. I think that engine, the F-350 is going to be a fantastic engine. It's the lightest of the 350 range. If you look at Suzuki, you look at Honda, you look at Mercury, all of them weigh a lot more. I want to say it's like 100 some pounds over, because the 4.3 liter weighs like 750 pounds or something like that. I'm not 100%. I think it's like 750, whereas everything else is a lot. It might be 726, low 700, somewhere around. It might even be under, I don't know, not off the top of my head, but it's so much lighter because everything else is a lot bigger. Honda's, it's a V8, not a V6. On Mercury, it's a V10, not a V6. So you got four more cylinders. Obviously, that is going to play a point in the amount of weight that it can move and the use of the engine. So like a V10 is obviously going to probably outperform the V6 as far as pushing weight, because it's a much larger engine. It's, you know, not a 4.2 liter. It's like a 6.7 or a 6.5, or it's a large, it has a larger displacement because it's a V10. So those are just a couple comparisons, but I think that the 4.3 is going to be outstanding. It's going to be very, very reliable. I think the 350 was very reliable, especially if you got a C model. If you got a 2016 to 2020, then super reliable. It's heavy, it's going to drink some fuel, but it's got tons of torque, tons of thrust. It's going to, you know, perform really good if you're trying to move some weight. So there's that. I also want to say that I've read, I haven't been able to find this. I don't know if, you know, how long the flywheel replacement deal is going to go on. I want to say it's the lifetime of the engine, but then again, I don't know. I know that there was a change in the flywheel. They did do a different manufacturer. So they did move over, I think, Mitsubishi in like 2016 took over the flywheel place or the construction. Not 100%, but again, there's no like true fix there. They're still changing those flywheels if you run 80 hours in that range. But, you know, usually, so you usually get 3 years of factory warranty, and then you can buy like 2 or 3 years of YES warranty. So I don't know if they're going to ever stop doing the flywheel replacement. If they were, I would say it'd probably be 2025, because 2020 was the last one that was made. So in 2025, there will be no F-350 out there that has any warranty. So I don't know. I don't know the whole deal there. You know, that's definitely going to have to be a question for a Yamaha dealer, whether or not that deal will continue to go through for how long it will. Moving on to Paul, he wants to know, are Mercury C Pros an interference engine? Well, Paul, it depends on, so a C Pro is pretty much a commercialized detuned engine. Mercury makes a C Pro model for pretty much their entire product line. So from the 600 all the way down to like the 30 or something, I mean, they make a C Pro model. The C Pros, some of them have different gear cases. Some of them are detuned as far as the RPM range that they will go. A lot of them are built and detuned like that to be a little beefier, to be used in commercial applications, charter captains, moving barges, you know, a work related type of engine. They did that to where it will, you can hopefully get more life out of the engine because it is, you know, detuned and structured in a way that it's meant to be used in a commercial application. So if it's an interference engine, that's going to depend on the model, because there are many models that Mercury does have that are interference engines. They do have some that aren't interference engines. So it's going to depend on the model of the engine. If is it a V6? Is it a V8? Is it a 50 horse? You know, what is it? And then that is going to determine whether or not it's an interference engine or not. So not really sure, you know, without knowing a specific model. And I definitely don't know off the top of my head all of the models that are interference and that are not interference. I would have to look all that up. Then we've got one says, hey, I'm a subscriber and I was wondering, I loaned my boat to a friend. Here we go. So I loaned my boat to a friend and the people who were on the boat said he was plowing with the boat, low RPM, wide open throttle, low RPM, wide open throttle. How do you, let me read that again. He says he was plowing with the boat, low RPM, wide open throttle. So I don't know how, I mean, wide open throttle is wide open throttle. So you got all the way down. You know, if you trim the engine up too high, then it's going to just blow out the prop. You're going to be on the rev limiter. So I don't know how you're getting low RPMs and wide open throttle outside of, I don't know about that one, but can this cause the valves to get water in them? Can this cause the valves to get water on them and stick? I have to rebuild the heads now. Oh, it was rough also. So I think you're missing some information. I think that there's definitely something going on here that is we're definitely missing some information. The low RPM, wide open throttle, I'm not exactly sure what you're trying to say on that one. As far as the water intrusion and bending valves and having to rebuild the head, you know, water intrusion is usually on something like that. If it's rough out and we're plowing, most likely the throttles got chopped at some point in time because water intrusion doesn't just happen, you know, it has to take water over. So like, you know, every engine has an above the water exhaust to it. So that way at low RPM, when there's a lot of back pressure on the propeller, it allows the exhaust to go out of the engine above the water line. And every engine has that. And then when you're obviously on plane and going at high RPM, the water and the exhaust just dumps out of the propeller because there is a vacuum and all that other stuff. Now, if you are running along and you know you're in a follow, were you in a following C or what's going on here, and you take the throttles from wide open throttle and bring them back and then get into reverse and chop them like that, then you know the boat's going to come off a plane and then the boat is going to be continuing to go and the water on the boat is going. So here's your boat. The water's coming over the back of it. You've chopped the throttles and you've got it back down. Now you're in reverse. The water is going to be coming like this. And then that force of the water on the propeller is going to move that propeller because it's physics. The water is going to move it. If you get a wall of water that comes over the back, you can suck up water through the exhaust. And that is usually where you get water intrusion to bend valves. Now, something like that sounds to me more like what's going on here. I don't know about the, you know, I think we're missing information if you ask me. I think you're missing information. Sounds like somebody chopped the throttles. You had water come over the top of the engines or you were backing down on a wave or something like that and the water came up over it and it was able to force water up the exhaust into the cylinder and then boom, lock it up, bend the valves. And I think something like that sounds more realistic. You're not going to get water intrusion just from running the engine unless there is something else going on. You know, you've got a failure that has happened over time, you know, corrosion or stuff like that, water and fuel. You know, there's other external factors that are going to get you to get water intrusion, not just running when it's rough. So I think you're missing some information and that sounds like somebody probably chopped the throttles. Eric says, do I need to remove the shift linkage before removing the lower unit? So when you're taking off a lower unit, it's going to depend on the model. If you have to disconnect the shift linkage or not, most larger engines, if you got a four cylinder or you've got, you know, a V6, a V8, an L6, anything big like that, most of them, you don't have to disconnect everything. Just drop the lower unit. Take the bolts out. There's bolts underneath the anode. You can pull the lower unit off and have no problems. Except on certain Johnson Evinrude products, there was a little bolt thing at the top. You would have to split the chaps on the sides so that way you can get access to the front of it. There'll be a little 10 millimeter bolt there. You can loosen that up. Some of them you'd have to take the bolt out. Some of them it would just loosen up and you could, like, you know, get enough room to where you can pop the pin out and then pull it out and the whole shift shaft would come out with a lower unit. And then on smaller engines, you know, 6 horse, 9.9, some 15s, 20s, you know, some of these smaller engines, they would have a, there's a coupler there, whether that be a coupler that's coupled together, or whether that is a screw coupler where you would screw this thing down onto the shift shaft or up onto the shift shaft, and then that would disconnect them, and there would be a connection point between the two shift shafts from the engine shift mechanism down to the lower unit shift shaft. That would be, you would have to disconnect that shift linkage. So it's all going to depend on the model that you have and the size of the engine on whether or not you're going to have to just disconnect a shift linkage in order to remove the lower unit. A lot of them, no. On some of them, yes. And then Brandon says, just curious what you would charge for a job like this. Talking about painting a lower unit. I really don't do much service like that anymore. A lot of everything that I do is all content related. So what I would charge my hourly rate is completely separate from what like a normal mechanic, if you were to just call a mechanic and have them come do something, or you call a fiberglass or a paint person. What I do is completely different. I don't really do hourly work like that anymore. But, you know, everything that I do is basically by the job, and a lot of it revolves around content creation. So as far as getting a lower unit painted, I would say you're probably somewhere, everything's going to depend on the paint that you use and how much paint that you use and what process you go through. Are you using all grip? Are you using rattle cans? Are you doing zinc chromate with a primer and the paint? Are you doing 3-4 coats of paint? Are you using a spray gun? You know, a lot of that's going to depend on how much it's going to cost because of the materials and then also the labor. Where are you at? How much are you paying like for labor? Is it $100 an hour? Is it $150 an hour? I would say that you're probably going to be in the range of maybe $400 to $800. Somewhere in there would be my guess of where you're going to be, $400 to $800 per lower unit. Obviously, that could go a lot more depending on, you know, the materials and who's doing it. You could probably be into the thousands if you're using, you know, high quality paint and doing 3-step processes and that whole 9 yards. So there's a lot of variables there, Brandon. I would say if you were to do it yourself, it's only going to cost you $100 or so because it's you doing it. But if you were to pay somebody, $400 to $800, I feel like is a safe number to go in there. And then someone says, I want to mount electronics on the inside walls of my center console without any screws penetrating. Do you have any videos on how to build up something like that? So there's going to be some questions on what exactly you're mounting. Now, what you're mounting is going to determine what you've got to build on top of your console. What does the inside of your console look like? What's the structure? What's the layout? What kind of space are we working with? Because the heavier the object that you're trying to mount, think about a boat when it goes through the water. It's taking a lot of, you know, hits. So every wave that you go over, the whole boat is just hitting, you know, it's like hitting a wall almost. The boat comes out of the water, goes in the water, out of the water, in the water, out of the water, in the water. With every wave, you're hitting a slam. And so if you screws are permanent, as soon as you put a screw in there, that's permanently fixed. Through bolts is even more permanent. But if you are trying to mount a backing plate onto something, you know, you can use epoxies and stuff like that. I would say is probably going to be what you're going to try and do to epoxy something on there. Or depending on the layout, you might have to make something like, if you got the floor of the console that you can get to, if you can create a bottom brace and then have a back to it. So like you've got, you know, an L shape like this. So here's the back that you're going to mount stuff to, and you've got a bottom to it. And then you put braces on both ends. You could build something like that if that's possible. Other than that, and because then you can screw that to the floor, or you could epoxy something to the wall to screw to. But if you're trying to mount a battery charger, a radar hub, an amplifier, like a heavier object, you're going to want to put some screws on there because that stuff's too heavy. If you're just trying to mount some fuses and like, you know, stuff like that that doesn't weigh a lot, you can get away with that. But it's going to depend on what are you mounting? What's the console look like? What's the space? You know, what... It's going to take some, definitely going to take some fabricating and some thought out of you in order as far as some creation, and you're going to have to get creative based on your situation with your boat. Blue Water says, are you a fan of powder coating T-tops? thinking about it, but worried it will start chipping. I am a fan of powder coating. I do like it. I think it looks really good. I think that you are going to need to think about chipping, and chipping is definitely a factor. It depends on how you use the boat. For me, I'm a fan of it. I think it looks really good, but it depends on you personally and what exactly you like. Are you really OCD and want everything to be super clean, super nice all the time? Because if that's the case, then I want to say that sometimes what it's been my experience that there's a lot of people that will get a boat that's really, really nice and everything's powder coated, and they don't really enjoy using their boat as much because they're too afraid of scratching it and, you know, putting a ding in it or whatever. And powder coating, yeah, if you're using the boat, if you're fishing, if you're diving, if you're entertaining, you think about what's going on. You've got rods going back and forth. You got gaffs. You got fish flying around. You got lead weights. You got, tools, your pliers and all that kind of stuff on your hips. You're walking up and down. You're fighting a fish. You know, you got the butt of the gaff. Things are going to get hit and eventually it will get scratched. Powder coating is way more durable than paint, and a lot of it will last a long time. You'll usually get quite a few years out of powder coating before it starts to chip. It doesn't really chip on its own unless it was powder coated incorrectly and there was stuff on the metal when it got powder coated. If there was, you know, grease or dirt or something like that, or you have a piece of aluminum that is pitting and you have a corrosion problem pre-powder coating, then depending on who does the powder coating, usually it's not just going to chip. Like, it's not just going to start chipping off. It'll take a long time for it to start chipping. And the way it starts to chip is it gets a scratch. So if you get a nick, a ding, a scratch, or something like that, like say you've got your pliers on your hip and you're walking up to the front of the boat to get to the cooler or to put, you know, a fish in the fish box, and you walk across it and scratch it with your pliers, then you're going to get to that bare metal. Once you get to the bare metal, now the salt air and the humidity of the outside air is going to get to the metal, and then that is going to work its way under the powder coating. That's what's going to make it start to chip and corrode. Also, normally where you have screws, so wherever you put a screw, like where at the base of it or at the top, where there are screws going through the metal, because you have dissimilar metals. The dissimilar metals creates galvanic corrosion, and that corrosion is what starts to build up under the powder coating. And then when that builds up under the powder coating, that's what makes it start to chip. So I think you'll get years and years and years out of the powder coating, and it's going to look really, really nice. But if it's going to make you not want to use your boat because you want to keep it nicer and you're afraid to scratch it, then I would probably not want to do it. But I think powder coating looks great, and I think it looks great. I like it. Rick wants to know, what do you think of fuel check valves? It depends on the boat and the application. If you have an inboard engine and you have a fuel line that dips below the fuel tank, then you need a check valve in there because it's an anti-siphon valve. So if there is a cut in that line, you need to be able to make sure that the fuel in the fuel tank cannot gravity feed out of the fuel tank and then fill your bilge up with fuel. That's what they're there for. There's a lot of outboard boats that don't have check valves because the fuel lines do not go below the fuel tank. So, you know, I think it's depends on the application. If you have fuel lines going below the tank, you have to have the check valves. It's like, you know, that's a safety issue. If you don't have fuel lines going above them, then they're, you know, it depends. Like, there's some variables there. There's also some ABYC stuff that dictate and determine which boats and which engines have to have check valves and which ones don't. So that's kind of my opinion. You've got some regulatory stuff on there that requires it. You got some safety stuff, and then also you have some application stuff. So depending on the situation, you know, it's what it is. I don't really have much of an opinion outside of that. Fish on Fishing says 2013 Verado 250 lower unit has four holes like on the tip below where the pedo would normally be. Are the holes factory? They are now irregular size. Hopefully you don't have corrosion, but yeah, on most of the Verados, there are holes in the front, and those are your low water pickups. a lot of engines have that. Basically what that is that for higher speed boats, you know, bass boats, flats boats, and other applications where you've got speed involved and you're getting the engine up out of the water, whether you're trimming it up or you got a jack plate. When you get up on the water and you're high speed, the holes in the front of the lower unit is a low water pickup. So it's going to take the water. You don't have as much water getting up to the top, you know, normal water pickup that's on the middle of the gear case. And so those low water pickups is what helps feed the volume and the amount of water to the engine and eliminates air bubbles from getting into the cooling system and having an overheat issue. So most likely that's what you're talking about. I hope that's what you're talking about. And yeah, they're supposed to be there. Cajun says, would you please talk to us about those scupper valves that are on this boat you're working on here, talking about 1720 Key West. I have a couple of floor drains that always have water coming up through them when the boat is in the water. And I'm wondering if these will help and if they would fit on my scupper holes. So application is going to be what we're talking about here. What he's asking about on the 1720 Key West, on the back of it, the deck drains out the back. So it's a deck drain. The freeboard of the engine or the boat is above the waterline. So those deck drains are above the waterline, but when you're standing in the back of the boat, they can dip down below the waterline. So there are these housings with, here's the housing, here's the transom, there's a ball in there. The ball, you know, kind of rattles around. So when water comes out, it pushes the ball out of the way, it rattles around, water goes out. And then whenever it goes under the water, water comes up in, pushes the ball, locks it into place, and water can't get into the boat. If you have scupper valves, you know, depending on the deck drains, some deck drains come down and then they go down in the bilge and they're under the water, so they let the water out from under the water. Usually there's a lot more freeboard there, but it depends. If you got a bay boat or a flats boat, a lot of those are so close to the water, they have, you know, minimal draft and they have minimal freeboard. So, you know, when you weight down the way down the boat, the freeboard gets to negative freeboard basically, and the static water line outside of the boat is above the deck drain. So yeah, you're going to have water that comes up in there. Most of them have a different type of it. And then also then one other type, just before we go talking about the scupper and what he could do to fix the problem, there are also just rubber ones where, you know, it's like just something on the back of the boat and it's got a rubber flapper valve there. It'll flap open like this when water comes out. And then when water comes on this side of it, it just pushes the rubber shut and doesn't allow the water to come in. But depending on the type of boat and the freeboard and where your deck drains are, that is going to kind of determine, you know, what kind of solution you can have. They do make other types of scuppers outside of those. If you have deck drains above the waterline, usually those do pretty well. Now, there are other ones for like flats boats and stuff like that where you have basically a negative freeboard and you know, the deck drains are like below. Usually there is a check valve in the drain out the bottom. So like, you know, if your drains are in the deck and they go into hoses and then they go back to through-haul fittings that then dump the water out below the water line, then usually somewhere in there, there's a valve of some sort. It's not really a valve. It's, you know, it's a diaphragm or it is some sort of, you know, I guess valve's the right word to use. Whether it be a ball, whether it be a duckbill or something to where water can flow in one direction, but it can't flow in the other direction. So, you know, do you need something like that? That may be it. Or if your deck drains are going straight overboard, then possibly, you know, if there's nothing on there now, then yes, as long as it's above the waterline. Or is it, what type of boat is it? Where you have a wet well or a splash well in the back of the boat, you know, old well crafts, Makos, Boston Whalers, stuff like that, where in the back where the engine is, you have, you know, like this separate little compartment where the engine trims up into, and they have drains that are below the waterline, but yet it doesn't get up to where it's in, you know, above to get into the boat until you get a lot of weight in the back of the boat that pushes that below. Then those can be a problem. But other than that, it might work for you. It depends on your application. We'll do one more. And Roy wants to know, huge question, just bought a used boat with an outboard, kind of new to boating, but it doesn't look right. It's an older bass boat and the three batteries, and there are three, and the three batteries in the same compartment as the fuel tank. Should I be worried and move the batteries? Here's another question. It's going to be application related. You know, that's one of the problems with a bass boat, like bass boats, bay boats, flats boats. A lot of them, you know, you are very limited in the space. And then we're also talking about boats that have minimal freeboard and they are, you know, the gunnels aren't very tall. These are boats that are meant to go into skinny water and get on plane to go quick. You know, they're just basically a platform that you're fishing off of in every direction. So some of them are meant to, you know, trim the engine up out of the water and use a poling platform to get up on, you know, really, really shallow areas. So space is always going to be a problem in one of these boats. My guess, if you're talking about three batteries, most likely these are the trolling motor batteries. I'm not 100%, but you know, usually depending on the boat, in the back there'll be, you know, a couple batteries for the engine and all your electronics, and then up in the front you'll have a compartment where most likely the fuel tank is going to be up there. And then also, when you add a trolling motor to the mix, three batteries go in for the trolling motor and you have limited space on where you can put the batteries. Is it ideal? No. Is it application specific? I would say definitely yes, because, you know, you think about the safety issue of it. You've got your fuel tank and you've got batteries. If you're changing your batteries out and, you know, you mess up and hook something up wrong, you create a spark right there next to the fuel tank. If there is a, you know, hole in the tank, or you've got a leak in your tank, or, you know, normally, obviously with time, things fail. But, you know, when everything's, you know, in working order, the tank's not leaking. It's vented to the outside of the boat. So there really isn't any way for it to catch fire. But again, we're, you know, you're talking about scenarios. There are regulations and there are standards to where things can go and what can be in what. But it's going to be application specific for this, whether you should move them or not. I mean, you might not have anywhere to move them. So a lot of them also are going to have some kind of divider. Usually the fuel tank is in its own separate compartment that's separated from it. So, you know, I don't know what kind of boat this is or, you know, what's going on. Most likely there is no other option. So, but usually the fuel tank's in a completely separate compartment, not, you know, in a wide open compartment. But I also don't have the greatest experience with bass boats. Like, I don't work on, you know, bass boats every day because I usually do offshore stuff, cuddy cabins and stuff like that, more flats boats, bay boats, center consoles, things of that matter. I'm not really on a river or a lake where people are bringing in bass boats every week. So I've not had, you know, 10,000 bass boats experience. But I would say maybe even take a picture of it and, you know, go to your local dealer or somewhere in your area, or even, you know, to call someone, email them the picture, see what they say, you know. And but you might be just overthinking it too. We might all just be overthinking the issue. So that's what I would say. Other than that, everybody have a great week. See you next time.